Mike Kribanoff and I again did a deep dive on a single prospect, this time Justin Jackson, who we're not that excited about, and explain why he might be a bit of an overrated prospect. Then we talk about players that dropped out or never even declared for this draft that are pretty strong prospects and how their draft stock might look going forward. We argue a little bit about Rodion Skoruks, and I bail on a half-baked analogy. I am Sean Darenthal, and this is Ode to Odin, the NBA Draft Podcast. Hey, Mike, how's it going?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, man. Today, I'm kind of excited because we're going to talk about Justin Jackson, and I'm not excited in the way that you might think. I don't really like Justin Jackson. I don't know where you stand on him. I think that you're probably in the same boat that I am, but I think it's valuable to talk about these guys, if only because we want to like provide like a counter narrative, right? If there's somebody that's high that we don't like, we want to give evidence why we don't like them, and I think that's valuable. And also, after Justin Jackson, we're going to talk about something that I think is a lot more interesting, actually. We're going to talk about guys that decided to either leave the draft or not even go to the combine, not even put their names in at the very beginning. So, obviously, we're going to talk about Miles Bridges there, Robert Williams, a few other guys that we're really interested in. But, yeah, let's start with Justin Jackson. I'm just going to give some background stuff, and then we'll jump right in, and Mike can take us off with offensive strengths. He is, I think most people know, he's a junior by now at UNC, has gotten, I think, an unduly amount of hype this year because of an improved jump shot. He's a pretty long 6'7", 6'8" wing. At the combine, he weighed in at 200 pounds, has a decent 6'11 wingspan. I think he plays a little bit longer than that, like, at least looks a little bit longer than that, maybe just because he's guarding twos and threes that are smaller at the college level. He looks really long. I thought that there's one thing that you hear all the time when you talk about Justin Jackson, and Mike, I want to know what you think about this. The narrative about him going to the combine last year, getting feedback from NBA teams, like, what do you guys want me to work on? And everyone told him to work on his three-point shot. So he came back over the summer, and now all of a sudden, he's this great three-point shooter. That seems like such a ridiculous narrative. I mean, one, if you're not already good at three-pointers, don't you think if you're a projected wing that you should be good at three-pointers? Like, why would you need someone else to tell you that? And two, let's say you don't make it that far, right? They're young kids. Maybe that's not something that's on their mind all the time. They're really busy. They're in school. They're worrying about girls and tests and basketball. That's fine. But, like, why isn't your agent or somebody else giving this feedback? Why is it, like, I don't know, this success story of the changed rule of the combine where you can enter, get feedback, and come out? I just thought it was such a ridiculous thing ridiculous narrative to push.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure people get feedback and stuff, but yeah, obviously three-point shot, everybody knows that you have to work on that, especially in today's NBA and as a wing.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let's start off with offensive strengths. Mike, why don't you start there?
Well, when we talked about Thornwell, you mentioned his ability to read screens, and Jackson is excellent in this. He really does great work before the actual screen as far as like setting up his defender and getting him on his back when he comes off the screen and allowing himself enough space to get his jump shot off or to curl into the lane.
Yeah.
Where he has like an array of floaters, flip shots, push shots. He can make them from a variety of angles. Really great at recognizing these sorts of off-ball situation. And I think he would be like a player that would be interesting in the 80s with guys like Alex English and Adrian Dally with the flex cuts and all that stuff, high-volume mid-range guy.
Mm.
He did improve his range this season, made a good amount of threes from the NBA line, has a pretty good post-entry pass. Carolina ran a lot of transition and like early offense, so he did a pretty good job moving the ball ahead, making outlet passes. So I can understand why some people really like him in the like pretty high, because like his constant off-ball movement and ability to recognize like spacing and get into the right spots without the ball is how he scored most of his points. So the idea is he'll be able to score a lot of points in the NBA since he doesn't need the ball in his hands. He's always moving. He has great stamina. So that's probably the reason why some people are so high on him, since he has shown the ability to be that high-level scorer with talent around him and within the team construct and not constantly having to run plays for him.
Yeah, that's really good. I'm glad you're being really positive on him. And I really like the thing that you talked about, stamina, because like in my notes, I usually have that as motor, right? But that also speaks to, well, maybe it speaks to character. I don't know, working hard, you know, in practice and running hard in wind sprints and all that kind of stuff. But also, the more and more that I've thought about this year, obviously there are some guys who are more have more natural stamina than other guys, right? Like some guys, it's easier for them to shed the excess body fat and to run for a long time. And for some guys that show up at the combine and post like a 9-point-whatever% body fat, I don't know if anyone was that high this year, but you know, they all get dogged in the media for their crappy work ethic and all that garbage, round face, blah, blah, blah. But you know, maybe like genetically, it's just hard for those guys. So that's actually a really good point. And the stamina one is a good point. I think like his offensive strengths, the magnitude of these offensive strengths is like pretty low. There's like really nothing that I would put in this category and say like, oh, this is like a huge strength. This is something that I feel super confident about him doing at the NBA level. Like almost nothing. So the one thing that I feel most confident about that I would say like might be there or might not be there is the catch and shoot, particularly from the corners. I'm not as, you mentioned kind of range from the NBA three. Talk to me about that range and how comfortable you feel. Like how many attempts do you think you saw? I know that's like hard to measure exactly, but are you talking? You're talking mostly about catch and shoot, not off the dribble stuff, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. Mostly off screens, and I'll get a little bit into it and the weaknesses. But he had a decent amount that he took. I don't know if he made like them at a super high percentage, but he looked comfortable taking them, and they weren't like way off or anything, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So most of those actually that I saw that were pretty long. So, okay, so a decent amount of those are off the dribble, like late shot clock stuff when their actions fail, blah blah blah, and he has to take a really bad kind of pull up from NBA range. A lot of those are really, really bad misses. A lot of the catch and shoot stuff that I feel really comfortable projecting was just, I'm sitting in the corner, like maybe on the weak side, maybe on the strong side, and like maybe coming off a screen, but most of the time he was just really set up. His motion catching and shooting is super quick. His shot is very, very reproducible. That's the one thing I think that you notice the most. There's kind of this weird thing. It's not as high of a release point as you think with somebody with his length and definitely positional size, just because he does this weird thing where he kind of arches his back a little bit and he releases from a little bit lower and he doesn't get a ton of lift in his shot, which I don't really think is a problem. That's not a big deal. It's so quick that that doesn't really matter. But I feel comfortable about that motion, about him sitting in a corner and catching and shooting that. He shot 37% this year and was always a decent free throw shooter somewhere in the 70s. So I feel kind of fine about that. The NBA range, I don't know how comfortable I feel about that. There was some catch and shoot stuff there that I didn't feel as comfortable with. Usually, I think from like the left side, he shot a lot better than the right side. I just thought it was like he was very, very mechanical. There wasn't a ton of fluidity to his shot. It's like not a very natural thing for him, it doesn't look like. And I wonder if like this is just me kind of, you know, not saying something that has a ton of substance to it, but I wonder if he's just kind of like not that natural shooter coordinated guy. Maybe he gets really sped up in situations. You see that in ball handling, in creation situations. And he just has to be like super, super, super practiced at this one little thing. And if he has to deviate from that, I think that there's just a ton of efficiency lost. The other thing is that I would say is a mild strength is passing. Now, not his vision, not his ability to like see passing lanes or any of that, but just the execution on a few passing touch passes across the court, kind of at unorthodox angles that you don't get a ton of practice at. He did those fine. Lob passes, a few of those he did right on the money. The timing was good. Over the top passes in the post, when the post is being fronted, is one of the most difficult, I think, kind of underrated passes that we see, just because that window closes so quickly and you have to get it there fast enough. So you can't like just loop it kind of over the defender too high, or the help defender will come in and mess that up. But it has to be high enough to get over that initial defender. So there's like some timing and some like speed issues and like right kind of just right height of the pass. And he did that several times. I think he got a lot of practice at that because UNC has that kind of motion system where they often have a high-low action. So like there's a lot of post-entry passes. So it kind of makes sense that after 3 years he might be kind of good at that, but I shouldn't take anything away from him on that. The passing, I think, was fine. But really nothing else do I feel very good at. You talked about some coming off of screens, and I think you're right about that. He sets his man up like really well. His man will often try to force him out of just the obvious curl around, and he'll kind of, you know, what's it called when you're skiing and you're going like in and out like the moguls or whatever. He'll go kind of in and out of the flags, you know, on the ski slope really well, actually, kind of just improvising that. But I still didn't see a ton of separation created. So we're kind of getting into offensive weaknesses here. Why don't you talk about some of the things that you saw that makes you kind of not as sold as maybe you sounded when you talked about the strengths?
Well, first of all, real quick, to be clear, I said he improved his range and he shot some NBA 3. I didn't say he's like, he has amazing range, and I'll get into that. Well, first of all, like you said, his ball handling is poor. Not a vertical athlete at all. One play stood out in the Florida State game. I saw he had a 1-on-2 in transition, and the defender was kind of playing the pass more, giving Jackson a little bit of a lane. The majority of NBA wings would be able to just explode and finish there, and Jackson didn't really trust himself, and he passed up the ball, and Florida State ended up stopping that play. So he does all his work without the ball, but if he's unable to create any space before he catches the ball, he won't be able to get any separation once he has it. If anything, the defender will be able to get better position to contest the longer Jackson actually has possession of the ball. In isolation situations, he struggled beating his defender into spots and turning the corner, lacks explosion, mostly stops short of getting all the way to the rim and opts for like his runners, which he's pretty good at, but that's still not an efficient shot. Not very strong, can't really finish through contact. He tries to create separation before the catch. He at times decides to shoot before he even catches the ball and gets into a shooting motion with his back still to the basket. It's impressive that he can hit some of those shots, but that's not a good shot or a decision.
Yeah.
Will not be able to even probably drive closeouts in the NBA, and he'll need to be really a knockdown three-point shooter to really be a, like, reach his potential as a top 20 pick, which he's considered right now. So since he shot in the low 30s in college prior to the season, I don't really see him as that sort of knockdown player. And a lot of the nifty, crafty off-ball moves he makes, his cuts, I think will be recognized, and NBA defenders and defenses will be able to take him away. It reminds me a bit of Chris Douglas Roberts, a wing who was very successful moving without the ball at Memphis, played with Derrick Rose, but was unable to translate any of those skills to the NBA. So because you lose a lot of that edge of craft and intelligence against better athletes and more experienced, smarter players, usually players like that are not very successful.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. Douglas Roberts was, I think, probably even like a much better athlete than Justin Jackson is. And like, that's the one thing. So you just basically read all of my notes. I would just say that basically, just to cap it off, there's almost no creation potential here, right? Like his handle, he just gets sped up really easily. There were several plays where it was almost like the defense knew there was like a wing pick and roll, and Tony Bradley or Hicks would roll and be wide open. Justin Jackson would be left double teamed. And there's this moment where, you know, you can put a bounce pass between the defenders. He has, you know, a decent, like, kind of wraparound one-handed hook pass that he did a few times. He couldn't execute that either. Over the top pass, he couldn't execute that. It was just in these situations with the ball, when he's, like, even a little bit pressured, he clams up or something. Like, something happens where, like, he can't perform at all. It's just, like, it's actually pretty discouraging because of a lot of like the little other things that you see that seem to make a lot of sense. Also the motor that he has on offense, like all these little cutting things, I actually, I don't think they're as, clever as maybe you suggested. So UNC runs, very few like actual set plays. They have kind of this motion system, and a few like decided actions out of that. But most of the time, like, it's kind of switch the ball side to side, some pick and roll on the sides, but a lot of like off ball cutting, a lot of off ball screening. And they're just like a lot. I know that system like a little bit just because that was what our high school ran. And there are so many little choices that he makes that I think are pretty deceivingly bad. So cutting when you're off the ball and you're cutting into the lane as someone on the strong side is driving in. If you're cutting into the lane from the baseline, like that's a really bad. You're often bringing your man to kind of just to double team the driver, which doesn't make any sense. Otherwise, you know, you should cut along the baseline or something like that, so you're open if your man decides to double team. There was a lot of decisions like that. It was kind of like this extra energy when it wasn't needed. You know, it was kind of like this, oh, I think I'm supposed to be moving, but like that's what the coaches are telling me to do, but I don't really know. I'm not moving with a ton of purpose. You know, like a lot of his screens just didn't make any sense. He was often screening for wings up on the wing to cut to the corner, which when the ball is at the top of the key, makes no sense at all. Like, that's like a fade pass that you throw that's open for like a split second. That sometimes you see like this, these fade cuts in the NBA right now are popular, but it's, it can only be in a set shot because the point guard has to know that that guy's going to be open and he passes him open, right? So like, you would never do that. You're the one who's supposed to cut off that guard screening you to the top. Anyway, I like, that's probably way too much about it, but just, I just noticed how much, how many little things that his offensive motor was actually kind of hurting a little bit, like creating anti-space. Sometimes you're supposed to just chill on the weak side and spot up, especially if that's your one freaking skill, right? Justin Jackson is a spot up shooter. Just post up in the corner for a half second, right? Like, don't go nuts. Let's space it a little bit as Hicks is working in the post, or, you know, Barry's driving or something off a high pick and roll. Just sit there for a half second and let something develop. Let some space happen. Like, he's often bringing his man into other space where rotations are just made a little bit easier. I don't know. That was actually kind of frustrating watching him because he definitely has this really good motor, which we're going to talk about is one of his big strengths on defense, I think. All right, I've been talking way too long on this, but it was like kind of frustrating for me. Yeah, so let's get to defensive strength so so it doesn't seem like all negative. What did you see on that end that is encouraging?
Well, he understands how to use his length fairly well. He legit surprised me with this, his on-ball D at times. He slides really well and has good technique on his stance. He should be able to guard most two guards in today's NBA. I think that's probably his best position to play, actually, in the NBA. He does a good job sticking with his man away from the ball, not losing focus, chasing off screens, good stamina, as I said. At 6'8", with a solid wingspan, he can really bother smaller jump shooters. Should be fairly effective chasing guys like Klay Thompson or McCollum. I mean, I'm not going to say he's going to shut him down, but should be decent chasing him off screens and sticking with them and bothering their jump shot. He, like I say, understands his own weaknesses and doesn't really try to do things that he isn't able to and to take too many risks. When he played somebody like Nigel Williams-Goss in the final game, he blocked him twice on ball in the championship. He did a fair job against Malik Monk both games when he was on Monk. Monk scored 47 points, but it was mostly against the other defenders, and he hit some really tough contested shots. Did a solid job versus Grayson Allen and Wayne Bacon as well. Kennedy Meeks is horrible in the pick and roll, so it shows how effective Jackson was at times, along with Vincent and company, that UNC defense was still top 15 in the country.
Yeah, I think like length here. So oftentimes doing this draft analysis, talking with some of our mutual friends on Twitter, it seems like the only thing that matters is your feel and intelligence, right? Jackson lacks a lot of that extra feel where he can really make good decisions outside of the scheme. But his length obviously makes up for a lot of that. So like, physical gifts are very, very real when it comes to NBA athletes. They don't have to be geniuses. They don't have to be Lonzo Ball or, you know, Thornwell, which we raved about last week as having these amazing anticipatory instincts. Jackson doesn't have that, but what he does have is length and a crazy motor. So like, UNC's defensive scheme is they overplay the ball so much. They're constantly in passing lanes. And so that means that they're really susceptible to backdoor cuts. And so they have to help really, really well. And all of them, including Jackson, Jackson might have been one of the better ones at it, are almost all on a string. Because, you know, they have a bunch of guys that are between 6'9 and 6'4 or whatever that are all kind of around the perimeter. And they do an amazing job of switching. Their defensive rotations are really, really crisp. Jackson is a big part of that. He reminds me kind of like some programmed algorithm where the coach is like, okay, you have to do this, 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 and this. In these situations, you know, these are the defensive principles, and he will do all of those things except for he won't really do anything else. Like, there's nothing else created. So I'm kind of getting the defensive weaknesses here, but there's no like added value, right? There's no recognition of some player's weakness. And so he guards him a little differently, or he comes off of help in kind of a way that maybe he shouldn't, but that makes a lot of sense to double team somebody who gets caught on the baseline, or to help on the weak side and get like a really easy block, or you know, preparation for rebounds, like little things that a lot of really good defenders, Thornwell included, add so much little extra value because of his decision making in the moment. Jackson lacks a lot of that. And, you know, the length and the motor are great. Him executing the scheme, that's all great. That is probably gonna, you know, allow him, if he's able to stick in the NBA, to stick, because he'll be a good defender and maybe he can just sit in the corner. But he doesn't add like anything extra. And for somebody with his length and I don't know, for what may seem like an athletic body type, not that he's a good athlete, I think, at all, he just lacks a lot of that anticipation. And so that's what makes me wonder a little bit about him as an on-ball defender in the NBA, guarding some of these really, really clever and, you know, super quick wings, threes and twos, that I think might just eat him alive on ball. Off ball, I think he'll be totally fine. But on ball, I worry. He could be fine, but I worry.
Yeah, basically, like you said, when he has to make a quick decision, he sometimes gets stuck in no man's land. Like in transition, he'll have poor recognition of matching up, or if he doesn't really have the awareness to make the right choice in more complex actions. And to add to that, you could pretty much cover the team defense weaknesses to me, but to add on ball defense, first of all, he, like I said, he understands his weaknesses, but he also at times relies too much on his length and kind of hedges against his own lack of athletic ability. So he'll give up, you know, too much space on the catch, and that allows like an easy pull up for a lot of guys. And, you know, while he's able to guard guys like Monk or Grayson Allen, who are not super quick off the dribble, you know, Monk is good, has good quickness, but his handle is not the best right now.
Right.
Against guys that are quicker and do have a pretty good handle, he's not going to be able to really keep up with them. And then lack of strength, he gets completely dislodged. I do not think he'll be able to keep up with the bigger wings in the NBA despite his length and height and everything. I don't think he's very switchable. Like I said, I think his best position at the NBA level as far as guarding is definitely the two. And except for, you know, some of the worst, you know, slow guard, point guards or maybe like smaller threes, he's not going to be able to switch too much effectively at least.
Yeah, okay. So now that we've completely railed against him, and I agree with pretty much everything you said, I think maybe we should have even hammered a little bit harder that he's really just not that great of an athlete. His contests are like kind of a little more ineffective than you'd kind of like on the closeouts for somebody as long as him. Let's get to projection. I hit on it a little bit, but what do you think are like, what is the optimistic scenario as far as him fitting in the league? Like, what does it look like if he makes a rotation? What is he going to be doing in the NBA?
Well, I guess if you're really going optimistic, his shot really becomes dependable, and he shoots like high 30s, low 40s. And, you know, a lot of that off-ball movement stuff actually translates, and he's able to provide a decent scoring punch off the ball without having to, you know, dribble too much or handle the ball too much. So I guess that would be the best scenario. I don't really see a lot of that translating. And like I said, I'm not super in on his jump shot. It's not bad, definitely, by any means. But I don't think he's going to be like a Kyle Korver or somebody like that where he's just like, you know, an elite jump shooter by any means. So I could definitely see him with the hype being drafted in the top 20 or even the lottery, but I wouldn't look at him as that type of player.
So where would you have him?
I'm working on my bid board right now, now that we have the official list, even though we're still not sure about some of the international guys. But I think I have a good top 60, 65 guys that I think I'm going to rank. Jackson, I'm probably looking at him somewhere like 40 range, something like that, 35 to 45.
Wow, that seems a little low, just because I don't know who else is going before that. Doing this, placing Justin Jackson in my tier system after doing like a lot of scouting, a lot of prep for this podcast, I realized that I really don't like the depth of this draft. Last year, I thought the depth was pretty good. In fact, there were a lot of guys that went undrafted that made a lot of rosters. And maybe that's just because teams, maybe there's kind of like a financial motive for that rather than anything else. But, and maybe it was just luck, right? That certain spots happen to open up this year more than normal or whatever. But I really don't like this draft's depth. And I think that while he'll go, like right now he's slotted on Draft Express to go 14. That's like a classic case of somebody who's a little bit higher in the season, drops down a little bit, and then right before the draft drops a bunch, right? Because I think everybody knows right now that he's not that good, but maybe Draft Express hasn't gotten around to changing it, or I don't even know what, right? We're still hanging on a little bit to our priors a little bit too much. But I think he'll probably go between that, let's say 14 to 20, something like that. 25 is probably his absolute floor. But 20 to 35, I think, is where I have him, just because I can't find a lot of other people to go ahead of him. There are just so many bigs at the end of this first round that I don't like at all. And that I'd rather take a chance on Justin Jackson, that, you know, his motor pans out. And like you said, I can stick him in the corner and he hits 37% from there and he's a good team defender. So I don't know. I think it's hard to project him. I don't feel good about necessarily drafting him at all. But I think if I have to rank him, I put him in that 25 to kind of 30-ish thing, just because there are there is a little bit of production there that I can't just ignore.
I mean, like I said, I haven't done the big board, so like 25 is probably a little bit too high. I wouldn't move the big. Probably not a huge fan of like a Bam Adebayo or somebody like that. I'd probably take him over.
Hold on 1 second. So like the way you're talking to the mic there was popping, and also for some reason I think my internet kind of cut out a little bit. So just start over whatever you were saying, like where I stopped. You just start.
All right. So I I'm not exactly sure of my big board. So like 30, 35, I could see him a little bit higher than what I said, but 25 is probably a little bit too high to me. Probably have some of the bigs you may not like maybe a Bam Adebayo or John Collins. Probably take a chance on them over Jackson, just because I'm really not very sold on Jackson. But with that being said, what I wanted to ask you, how surprised would you be if Charlotte takes him at number 11? Jordan?
Crazy surprised? I don't know. I mean, There are several wings that I would definitely have above him at 11. I mean, I would take Juwan Evans over him in a second. Obviously, Donovan Mitchell is probably – are we saying he's gone before then? OG Anunoby, for sure, I'd take before him. Kurucs, although not everyone's looking to stash somebody. I may even take P.J. Dozier before him. P.J. Dozier's upside is just so much higher. I'm definitely taking Thornwell before him, right?
Yeah, I am, but I'm saying Michael Jordan, North Carolina.
Let's hope not. I mean, I know that Charlotte has kind of a fraught drafting history this past few years and like some real head scratchers, but I don't know. I mean, for them, I hope that they get Collins. I think Collins should go before that, but if they get Collins, they should just be crazy excited, regardless if it's another white big man. I think he's going to be really good. Anyway, all right. Anything else on Jackson? Anything else that we missed? Were we too hard on him? Were we being unfair?
I think we're pretty good. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of his, so it's... I mean, I said what I said, like, and you pretty much more or less agree. I think you're even a little bit higher on him than me, so...
Yeah, I think maybe I bash on him more, but I had him higher ranked than you did. and maybe that's just a component of...
Well, you hate the depth of the draft.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't like the depth. I don't hate it. Like, I mean, I know you don't hate it either, but I mean, yeah. I'm probably a little higher in the depth than you are.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Let's get to guys that either dropped out. I think last night was the deadline, right? Or that didn't even enter at all. The guy that we have to talk about first, obviously. Well, actually, I don't know. Who do you think would have gone higher this year, Miles Bridges or Robert Williams?
Miles, I mean, you're asking, who are you asking, dude? Come on, what do you think I'm going to say?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're the biggest Bridges fan I know. You probably would have drafted him top five, wouldn't you?
Yes, sir.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you may have swayed me a little bit. I think Robert Williams, he was hanging on to a ton of hype early on. I think he probably still would have gone for sure in the lottery, maybe top 10. I think I probably would have had him above Zach Collins. I'm not sure. I love Zach Collins a lot. So maybe just behind Zach Collins. But I think pretty safe top 10 guy, unless you really love Donovan Mitchell. But so let's talk about Bridges a little bit. So why don't you just tell us why you think he went back to school, where I guess you already said you would have had him top five if he had come out. But realistically, where do you think he would have been drafted? And then talk to us about the context. I know there are a few big names that are going to be going to Michigan State next year. So is this helping his stock or do you think hurting it?
I think it's a very risky choice. Personally, I have horrible luck, so I would never take this risk. But for him, no, I mean, it could go bad, like especially if the shot is not real. But I'm a big fan, you know, and I have him fourth on my 2018 big board right now. I believe Draft Express actually has him around the same spot. So for now, at least he's projected to go higher than he likely would have gone this year, where he probably would have been towards the lower end of the top 10 or maybe even later in the lottery, perhaps. It'll be definitely interesting how Tom Izzo uses him next year because Jaren Jackson and Nick Ward are their two other best players. So perhaps he'll be playing at the three. I do think that Miles will be able to develop his perimeter skills, in particular ball handling, enough to become a three eventually. But at this point, it definitely might be a little bit of a struggle for him, especially early in the season as he gets used to that position. But I think overall, Izzo will figure out a rotation where he kind of moves those three guys around between the big position. Maybe Miles plays a little bit of the three. And if he, you know, takes a good jump with some of the skills, like I believe he can, he could have a really big, dominant season. And I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up as high as like number two or something like that. But again, I'm a big Miles Bridges fan. I'm a big believer of his game.
Yeah, obviously it was really risky. I know that we talked a lot about this, and there was a ton of discussion on Twitter earlier about, you know, why did he do this, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't make a ton of sense. You said that his stock could go up, but also you mentioned that it was risky. I really worry about it just because what if he doesn't show market improvement? What if he's on like a normal growth curve? That often for your hype is really bad. I think we kind of... sophomores that are kind of in their normal growth curve, for some reason, because the ceiling is maybe a little more capped, like we don't see some monster ceiling developing, that he gets downplayed a little bit. Like, I think it might hurt his, like there's a large potential for this to really, really hurt his draft stock. Because right now, definitely at the end of the season, he was playing so well. And really at the beginning of the season, he was playing almost as well, just really consistently. And at the end, I think he was playing even better, that I don't know how his stock could get any higher. I know this was pretty strong at the top. So like maybe if this is some kind of calculated move where he wants to get drafted higher, like better guaranteed money, next year's crop of wings is definitely weaker. So maybe there's something to be said about that, or maybe not just wings, but like overall perimeter players. But yeah, coming back where he's going to potentially have to share the court with two other bigs, potentially, we'll see if that, you know, is a common lineup, him with a three. I hope not, but you know, that could hurt a lot actually. And yeah, we'll just have to see how it works out. It sounds like he went back for like personal reasons, for like happiness, right? Which is great, right? These guys should do what they want. This is merely a discussion about what makes most like financial and kind of draft position sense, which are the same thing basically. But yeah, Mike, what else?
Yeah, first of all, I don't think it was some calculated master plan. Like you said, I think he just wanted to play Michigan State. I think he's good friends with Jaren Jackson, and, you know, he wants to play with this guy or whatever. He likes college experience, whatever. But the reason I'm a big believer in his game is when I saw him in the AAU as a rising senior between his junior and senior season, he was okay, but I wasn't a huge fan. But then I saw him play later on in his high school career as a senior, and he improved. And then I saw him play the first game in Michigan State, and he looked a lot better. And by the end of the season, he had his best game of the year, arguably, against Josh Jackson in the final game. So he consistently improved every time as I watched him over the past 2 years. So that's one of the big reasons, not a big, huge reason, but like it makes me believe in him improving. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so high on him, is I think he's somebody who's consistently improved over the last few years.
Yeah, that's a big deal, obviously. If you can add skill to some of the freak athleticism qualities that he has, you know, not the biggest physical specimen in some regards. Like, I don't know that his wingspan is great. His height isn't, you know, overly imposing or anything like that. But yeah, there's obviously a lot of physical gifts. If you can add some skill to that, definitely next year he could be a high pick. Let's go to Robert Williams really quickly. Was he holding on too long to that early season hype where his block percentage was like over, I don't know, what was it? It was like 15% or something crazy. I don't even know if it was that high. But I think later in the season, his stock maybe was kind of coming down. It sounded like he went back, though, for different reasons. He was definitely a lock to go in the lottery, some big-time guaranteed money. So I don't know if you heard anything about why exactly he went back. It was a bit of a head-scratcher for me. And then talk to me about the context there at Texas A&M and how this might hurt or maybe help his draft stock.
Yeah, I'm not sure why he went back. I would guess he would also just wants to play at Texas A&M another year. He likes it there, I guess. I think what he said was is that he feels like he could improve and become a top five player or whatever. I'm not sure how much of that is going to happen since he played a lot of small forward this year, and Tyler Davis is going to be back, and Trocha Morelos is going to be back, and Eric Villa is going to be back. They're adding some good guard play too. There's a very underrated prospect they're going to have next year, Deshaun Corprew, somebody who I'm a big fan of, sleeper to watch in the SEC. But Robert Williams, I actually think he improved throughout the season too. Maybe his block numbers went down, but he did a lot better job of, you know, not chasing blocks and just block hunting and being out of position, but actually playing, you know, smarter, better defense, in my opinion, at least, and showed himself to be a very capable passer and improved his jump shot a little bit. But with that said, this move was definitely a head scratcher, and especially at my big board in that range, once you get outside the top four, which to me right now is Miles Bridges, Doncic, Michael Porter, and Colin Sexton, the next five guys are DeAndre Ayton, Wendell Carter, Mohamed Bamba, and Mitchell Robinson, along with Robert Williams. So if those guys come in and have impressive freshman season, I could really see Williams kind of sliding, because the NBA doesn't really need bigs right now. And since there will be so many of these talented bigs available, any team that needs a big will take one of those guys, and then Williams could end up the odd man out.
That's interesting. So this whole take, I know you weren't going there, but this kind of reminds me of this rant that I often go on in my head as I'm listening to some podcast and somebody's talking about the depressed center market and how bigs are undervalued and blah, blah, blah. Like, so clearly that's true overall on average, but the league is always looking for people who can protect the rim and who can also provide some athleticism on offense, right? So these guys are still as valuable as ever, maybe even more so, because they really have to anchor a defense that's made up of a bunch of perimeter players, and not everyone has, you know, great perimeter defenders. So I think that while most centers in the league, you know, Vucevic and Valanciunas, Jahlil Okafor, these guys who are super offensively skilled in one way, their stock is going down. And guys who aren't great rim protectors and aren't great dive men, athletic, switchable guys, they're bad. But Williams, I think, is the kind of prototypical rim protector that the NBA does want. So I think his kind of positional value is helped by this trend in the league a little bit. But like you said, this next class is pretty heavy with athletic bigs at the top, or like potentially, right? We'll see how it kind of pans out. And I'm actually pretty high on Williams. And I wonder if this will help him, if only because I think this draft at the top was really strong. And I think next year is going to be a little more disappointing than we're kind of hyping it up to be right now. So I think that this will be eventually a good choice, but as far as like which slot he'll be drafted at, but as far as just starting your rookie contract as early as you can, right? Like in the long run, this actually might hurt him a little bit financially, not too much. He just won't get to that second contract as early, won't get to his rookie extension as early. Honestly, this isn't a big deal. The only thing to worry about is sometimes he was stuck at the three last year, and it looks like he might be stuck at the three even more so, right? So the same kind of thing that we talked about with Bridges, A&M's best, you know, player kind of in that college context, what's his name? Help me out.
Tyrone Davis.
Yeah, Davis. I mean, he's the man there right now, and he's going to be a man there for the next 2 years, right? So I don't know. I can see it both ways. I think that he is a perfect fit for the modern NBA, but also the roster around him at A&M is an awful fit. And because he's so talented, they're going to have to play him, and he might, you know, play more three like he did his freshman year than anyone wants him to.
Two quick things. First of all, I forget right now, but the other thing I was going to say is they played a lineup with DJ Hogue, Eric Villa. DJ Hogue is 6'8", Eric Villa is 6'10", Robert Williams, Trosha Morales, who's 6'10", and Tyler Davis, all in the same time. So nobody was shorter than 6'8". So yeah, I don't know. I think their best players are all like 6'10" and above, except Corpru, who, again, watch out for Corpru. Oh, but the other thing I wanted to say is obviously the bigs that could protect the rim and are like have defensive value are more valuable than the offensive only one-way bigs. But still, like, the Spurs got Dwayne Dedman for like $3 million a year this past year. Like, bigs overall are going down, not just guys that are offensive only. Offensive only, it's even worse, but even bigs like Robert Williams still losing value, don't have as much value, at least as you would think they would in the vacuum.
Interesting. All right, so let's get off those two guys. We spent a lot of time there, but let's talk about a few other guys that we think could have been first rounders that for some reason either pulled out or never declared in the first place. Talk to me about Hamidou Diallo. He's probably not the guy on this list of mine that I think would have been drafted the highest. other than obviously Bridges and Williams that I'm talking about. But it's so, his decision is so fresh. Like, what was it? It was at like midnight last night, right? That he did. All of Twitter was waiting in anticipation, watching for, you know, whether the Cinderella would turn back into the analogy is going nowhere. So I'll just end it there and turn it over to you. What are your thoughts on Hamidou Diallo's decision? Could it possibly help him?
Yeah, I don't see it helping him at all. The only thing that's possible is the last 6 months. Obviously, I haven't seen him play since he was playing in high school, Putnam Science. Maybe he greatly improved the skill. I mean, guys around his age, it's happened before where they take a jump in skill level. You know, it's possible. But from what I have seen, I think this wasn't the greatest decision. I think with his athletic measurements being what they are, he could have probably been drafted late in the first, early in the second. Right now, I think he's the fifth best prospect on Kentucky next season. Well, wow. Who do you think are the, and that's what I wanted to ask you, who's the best player in Kentucky next season, or who are the best prospects?
Oof, that's really hard. Honestly,
because I see Kevin Knox, PJ Washington, Quade Green, and my guy Shai Gilgeous over Diallo. Like, Shai is more arguable. That's just my personal opinion. But the other three, I think, will be clearly better players right now. And even despite Diallo's athleticism, they're just so far ahead in skill and understanding of the game that I think they'll make themselves clearly the top three prospects on UK next season.
All of those guys have such big flaws that I wonder, I don't know, in my mind, they're all really kind of just there in a big pack of either not athletic enough and have some skill, or, you know, show some athleticism but don't have enough skill. I don't know. I might say Diallo, in my mind, is a little bit ahead of everybody else just because of that group. And I know some of those guys are athletic for their position, but Diallo is literally like world-class athletic, right? So I wonder, I mean, obviously there's a lot of skill development that needs to happen there. I don't know, man. That's a really good question. I think they're all kind of just tied. I don't think anyone really sticks out to me as being above the pack, or at least above Diallo so much so. Like maybe Knox. Obviously he has more skill, but he's not even close to being as athletic as Diallo is.
Oh, I think Knox is, well, considering his size, he's a little bit closer than you think. But I think Diallo, not only the skill is the problem, this is, if it was just like some skills, but he shows some flashes, I wouldn't even be as, like, you know, low on him.
Yeah.
But the thing is the feel. Like, I don't think he understands, like, that's like what I really value highly in basketball players when I'm scouting, is like instincts. Like, we talked a little bit about Dennis Smith before the podcast. So I don't know if he has, you know, the right mental approach to really be a successful basketball player and really take advantage of his athletic ability outside of like open dunks and transition and stuff like that.
Yeah. All right. I am super curious to see. Or you know what? Actually, I lied about that. I am not looking forward to watching Kentucky games next year at all. I think it's going to be an awful mess. The spacing is going to be horrible. The creation there, I think, is going to be much worse than people think. It's going to be just like a defensive mash, right? Where there are so many athletes everywhere that, you know, they're going to be scoring like 60 points a game. Like I think it's going to be relatively ugly basketball when they're on offense. It'll be exciting to see on defense, but I am excited to maybe read people's takes on Twitter. Let's say it that way. That will be more exciting than actually watching the basketball, how people feel about Diallo, because he is such a mystery right now. And he is such a freak athletically. All right, let's get to a few other guys. I want to hear your take on, like, pick maybe two of the three of these guys. D'Anthony Melton, who I kind of love irrationally. McCall Bridges, who's very interesting. And Bruce Brown, who I think are probably the next three biggest names that could have been first round picks, or at least should have been first round picks in this year's draft.
Yeah, I also like Andrew Jones, but I know he had kind of an up and down combine. So I think people kind of said that he's only athletic and doesn't have skills. But I truly believe in his ability to play the point guard. I feel like the Longhorns' offensive struggles, had a lot more to do with their lack of spacing than Jones's guard play or lack of playmaking. I think he actually had pretty good vision for the most part. Maybe not the most polished, but he was fine, I think, overall. But as far as the other guys, Mikal Bridges, probably, no, I like Melton. You know what? I'll go with Melton. he actually went to high school down the street from where I'm recording right now. So, you know, I'm a big fan, obviously. I when I saw him in high school, he was like the 300th ranked recruit or something. I mean, I knew he was good. I knew he was better than that, but I did not expect this, like, in his first year, I'm not going to lie. Yeah. But, yeah, I definitely think he could be, in my opinion, he was probably top 15 this year for me. But next year, definitely, after all those super high-level talented freshmen, I think I have him, like, number 11 on my 2018 big board right now. Super young and great, great. Talk about feel and instincts, high, high level. And at times, he was just able to completely take over a game defensively. And that's really impressive for a perimeter player, especially for a freshman.
Yeah, I am in love with Melton. Like you said, the feel is there. Like, the offensive creation instincts and some of the skill to go along with that can be lacking. But as a defender and as a passer and just understanding kind of the offensive spacing and the nuances of the actions that they were trying to run, and like what the real goal of some of these actions were. Like, what is, you know, what's the point of you know, this type of screen or that, or, you know, why are we running this specific dummy action? It was very polished, and just, I don't know, it was a pleasure to watch him, even though he wasn't necessarily the most flashy or productive offensive player. I don't know where this is going to go. If he puts up similar defensive metrics, like his steal percentages were off the charts, you know, something that really, really matched the eye test with him on defense. Block percentage, rebounding for a guard, for a point guard, is good. I think if people are just labeling him as a point guard, that's going to hurt him a little bit, maybe. But I'm really excited to see where he goes. I'm interested. Why do you think he didn't even put his name in the list? Why wouldn't he even go to the combine? Is there some pack there at USC? I mean, I know they have a few guys there. They were kind of, you know, on the draft bubble, or at least their hype wasn't maybe as big as people thought it was. Chimezie Metu, right, went back. I don't know. They have a few other guys that I thought were maybe on the second round bubble, something like that, that might play in Europe. I don't know. Are all these guys trying to come back and like make a run at this tournament or something? What's going on? Why wouldn't Melton even try?
I don't know. I know I saw an interview with him before his freshman year, and he wasn't exactly like super confident in his own ability to be a one and done. You know, he was pretty realistic about it. He's like, yeah, you know, if I don't make the pros, I'll have my USC degree, and I'm just working towards that. So I think that's kind of a goal for him. And he didn't really emerge on more like the mainstream consensus draft scene until later in the year. So I don't know if he, like, you know, he just, that's not something he was planning out. He wasn't sure that he was actually a big time prospect in this draft. Like, he didn't realize maybe how high he was regarded. So he just kind of like, oh, I'll wait another year, you know? And yeah.
Yeah. So, Bruce Brown, did you touch on him? Cause he's somebody that's interesting. Somebody that, as I was trying to slot Justin Jackson in and kind of hating the depth, I was really like ruining the fact that Bruce Brown wasn't there, because I think he could have potentially slipped into the lottery.
It's possible. Yeah, he's a bit older for a freshman, and I'm not sure how much he could really create for himself right now off the dribble in the half court. And, you know, his playmaking skills need polish, needs more defensive focus. So I don't think he's like a amazing, perfect prospect by any means, but definitely with the need for perimeter players, with his intensity and effort on both ends and explosive abilities, he's a good vertical athlete. You know, he'd definitely be an interesting, somebody interesting to look at, maybe around top 15.
All right. So let's wrap this up quick and get to anybody that you think should have maybe gone in, or that if they had gone in, they would have been a second round pick. Anybody that you, had your eye on that you were scouting all season that decided not to.
Well, there's two guys I want to – well, let me just quickly say Mikal Bridges. We didn't talk about him.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it was a pretty decent decision for him not to enter, because I think next year he'll probably get more of a chance to play with the ball, and his efficiency will probably go down. But he'll have, you know, more the type of stats that more traditional scouts are looking for, if you know what I mean. So yeah. That might actually get him drafted as high as we think he deserves to be. Mm-hmm. But the guy I really want to talk about is Felipe Dos Anjos, somebody who's a legit 7'3" center playing in Spain right now. He didn't have the best showing at the Nike Hoop Summit and is definitely raw, but he was arguably the best or second best player on one of the two or three best teams and LEB Gold, which is Spain's second division. Meanwhile, Rodion Skuroks, who's the same age, was only like barely top three player on one of the worst teams in the same league, and was clearly less effective than Dos Anjos against the same competition. Not to mention Dos Anjos outplayed Kurucs at youth tournaments that they both appeared in. I understand that Kurucs supposedly being a 3 is much more at a premium, but it's absolutely ridiculous to consider Kurucs a top 20 pick and dismiss Dos Anjos as somebody who's not even an NBA player or shouldn't be drafted. You know, if Dos Anjos shouldn't be drafted, then Kurucs shouldn't be doing D-League tryouts.
So I have a feeling that... for some reason, you have some personal vendetta, maybe against Kurucs, or at least for Dos Anjos. I've heard you rant about him several times now. I am very curious to see where this goes in the long run. Honestly, I have put little to no effort into scouting him. I don't really have an opinion. Obviously, I value yours, so I'm definitely going to lean, you know, on the good side. I'm definitely going to give him a chance. But some other guys that you and I both respect also kind of were unimpressed with him at the Hoop Summit this year. So I don't know. We'll see. I'll do my due diligence later and get back to you. Let's say that.
Yeah. But about Kurucs, I just think it's ridiculous that he's in the top 20. It's just because nobody saw him play and Draft Express put him in the top 20. So he's like, yeah, he's a wing. He's athletic. Yeah. It's like, dude, he's.
But before his injury, he was dominating the youth scene there. I mean, that league that you're talking about, the second Spanish league, that gold league there, he did. I think last year he completely dominated it, right? Before his injury.
No.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm 100%. This is his first year there. He played in the youth tournaments last year, but he had a bunch of injuries. First of all, he's always injury prone. Second of all, he played off the bench for the under-18 Barcelona team. He didn't even start over Eric Villa, who barely gets on the court on Texas A&M.
Okay. Of what I've seen of Kurucs, I'm a little bit higher on him than you are. But yeah, I don't know exactly. Like, I'll have to look at – I know Lane Vastro does, or at least did a while ago, and I'm sure it's changed a lot. But I'll try to find some kind of comparative ranking value of where that league stands. It's nowhere near, you know, the top leagues in the NCAA, the top divisions in – not divisions. What am I going for? Conferences in the NCAA. So I'll have to go back and look on that. I think I'm probably a little bit higher on them than you are. I know there's not great film on him that's like for free on the internet or like on some, you know, garbage Russian sites that you can download some, what do you call it? Shoot.
Torrents.
Yeah. That you can download some torrents of him. It's difficult to find film, but of what I saw and of, some of the European guys that I talked to before, this season, they did like him. So that's interesting. That's interesting. I'll have to go back and scout him a little bit more. I know this wasn't supposed to be about him. This is supposed to be about Dos Anjos, but that's how this podcast goes. Guys, we probably went way, way over, and this may be crazy boring, but again, this is what I really, really love doing. I love giving kind of the nitty gritty, a little bit of substance where sometimes I think it's lacking on other outlets or other podcasts. So, and of course, those are good too. Everyone has its place, and this is ours. Thank you for listening. Mike, do you have anything that you want to plug before we get out of here?
No, I think I'm good. I'm just working my big board. Hopefully you let me publish it again on your site. Maybe I'll do it.
Of course. All right, so Mike's big board coming soon. Let's hype that up. And just follow me on Twitter. Get at me at my email, otoodinpodcast@gmail.com. Ask some questions. Mike and I have a lot of topics we want to get to. There are a lot of breakdowns that we still want to get to. Obviously, if we're going to take 40 minutes on every potential second rounder, we have a lot of content. But we want to hear about what you guys have to, even though we may not address it on the podcast if we don't think it's something that's interesting or that we want to talk about. But a lot of listeners have emailed me, especially recently, with some things that have made me really think. So, email me, please, suggestions about topics, questions that you have, even takes that you have. A lot of smart people have been emailing me recently, and I appreciate that a lot. So thanks again. This is Ode to Odin. I'm Sean Darenthal. That's Mike Gribanoff. We'll talk to you later. See ya.